At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
This is the Blue Moon Podcast. Coming up, we've got all the news and views from Manchester City's week. It's your club, and this is your show.
Two wins and two clean sheets from two games that earlier in the week were seen as fairly tricky for different reasons. And would you look at that? There's that feeling of confidence back once again. Always good to give United a hide in, but then a pretty straightforward evening against Napoli was helpful ahead of a quick turnaround going into Arsenal. Ahead of the Manchester derby, we had the sad news that the boxing world champion and the big City fan Ricky Hatton had died. We'll discuss his legacy and hear some of our archive interview with him later on as we speak to City fan and football and boxing journalist Dom Farrell. Then also later on in the show, we'll see how misplaced our newfound confidence is as we speak to the Arsenal fan Michael Kashani. Plus, we'll hear from the Huddersfield fan Matt Shaw from the podcast Andy Takes That Chance, all about next week's League Cup tie as well. And in my desperate attempt to cram more and more stuff into the podcast each week, on top of all of that, we're going to take a look at some memorable City goals where the scorer has kissed the badge in celebration, thanks to Phil Foden's derby opener. No time to waste then, so let's get on with it. I'm David Mooney. I am joined this week by, from the City Ramble podcast, Amos Murphy.
Hello.
And City fan Chris Higginbottom.
Hello there.
Hello, hello. Amos, you good?
No, I will be honest. I'm not doing a Frank Sidebottom impression on purpose. I've just been at some super spreader event that I think most of the greater Manchester has been to. So on a footballing point of view, yes, but on a physical point of view, no.
Yeah, well, cotton wool for about an hour. You'll be fine. Then we'll get you back to bed with some Lemsip. You'll be good. Higgy, please tell me you've avoided the lurgy.
So far, so good, said the man falling off the 40-storey building. but yeah, I mean, considering I have a child that's just started school, I go to work on the germ wagon that is the Metrolink, and it's start of year at the university I work at, so you've got students from all over the globe piling in. It's quite a collection of petri dishes that I kind of dwell in, and I managed to evade it thus far.
Well, Godspeed. Keep it going. We're all thinking of you from our houses with big red crosses painted on the door. Let's start with the Manchester derby and Napoli this week, because Amos, after a year off of not beating United, it's pretty fun to do it again, isn't it?
Oh, yeah, totally. I mean, I'm part of the team where it is the one game every season. If you can guarantee me a win, it's the win that I want to get. And I was just, given the context heading into it, it was very weird because it was the first game after an international break, which is never fun from a sort of preparation point of view anyway. But not only that, it was the first game after an international break, the first international break of the season. So off the top of my head, I was asking my dad this, who's, followed City for decades, and I will say his memory isn't that good, but he couldn't remember sort of how early on playing United this early on in the season. He said maybe there was one in the 90s or the 80s, but at the same time, it felt like there were so many trip hazards for City because of the previous two defeats and the way that obviously performance-wise, it hadn't necessarily been that impressive. City dealt with it very comfortably, and you know, you can never complain about beating United, but when you properly spank them, as I thought City did. I know you differed in opinion a little bit, David, which is interesting, but I thought, considering how City had been previously, I don't know if they got out of fourth gear, which was I thought was impressive.
Oh, that's interesting. I didn't even think they got up to fourth gear.
Interesting. Ooh.
I thought Napoli was a much more complete performance.
I'd agree
than the derby was. Yeah.
Yeah, I totally agree there. Although I think maybe my sort of confidence on the back of it was boosted by the fact City had looked decent enough against Brighton and at times okay against Spurs. But they did, don't get me wrong, they were more fallible than maybe, you know, previous Pep Guardiola performances. But at the same time, I'd say that's probably what we're going to have to expect from this new look City. You know, control is so yesterday. They might have to concede a few chances, but when you've got that 6'5", you know, shiny new goalkeeper between the sticks, I don't know if you can complain that much. But yeah, I, and you know, I think you can't underestimate the emotional boost that it brought. You saw at the end the sort of the impromptu lap of honour, which might not have been as impromptu as we thought at the time, because they also did it against Napoli on Thursday. But like the smiles on the faces, I think City could not afford to have not won that game. And however it arrived in the end, I think, you know, you say, yeah, fair enough, win's a win.
So, Higgy, I mean, like, in terms of performances as well, it's interesting there, like, because Amos is right. I didn't think the Derby performance was that good. I thought, obviously, it's good to get the win and good to beat United. But I thought it was a bit loose. There was a lot of things that could have been tightened up, and a lot of times when I wasn't really sure that City were on top of United in the way that they have been in previous years. Obviously, Napoli's a different game with the red card, but it felt even before the red card, City were a lot more stable in that, a lot more kind of what they more like what they used to be. Where do you fall on this for this week?
Fairly similar, I think. I mean, approaching these fixtures, it was a real kind of litmus test, and it could either be a signifier for a torrid season or a springboard into something far more positive. Obviously, you don't want to get too carried away with a couple of wins, as you shouldn't with a couple of defeats. But the Derby, I think we were good enough, obviously. There was a bit of trepidation. I think there was an air of kind of anxiety pervading the whole fan base and team, the way we've been playing, because I don't think anyone expected us to be quite so kind of abject after the Wolves game, where everyone's like, we're winning the lot. It's happening, it's all on. And then it's like, oh, no, it isn't. But we were good enough to beat United. But yeah, there was a few big chances where if they'd have been a bit more polished, then, you know, the sort of chances that you wouldn't be surprised if we'd conceded, and we got away with that to an extent. But I think the confidence that's given us, and 3-0 is a bit of a spanking, it really did provide a bit of a psychological boost as well to go into the Napoli game. And I think we had a bit of swagger back, which perhaps, I wouldn't call it a stuttering Derby win, but like you say, it wasn't as convincing as perhaps you would like, but it was good enough. And that's the sort of thing that, you know, gives you the confidence to put in a more polished performance against Napoli. But again, even with Napoli, it was a bit of an odd one. The sending off kind of spoiled it a bit, because you can't really take stock in what you're seeing as much as if we'd have beaten 11 players. You know, De Bruyne goes off, that kind of, yeah, it was a bit of a dampener in a way, even though you think, oh, you know, 10 men, we've got a better chance. But it kind of spoiled the way you can view what to take from it in a way.
Yeah, the quality of the litmus test. I don't know what's the scientific term. Like, there must be a control. Like, the control element of the test is now no longer there. I don't know. I'm not a scientist. It probably shows. There's an interesting thing there that Amos said as well, Higgy, about the vibes thing, because Guardiola went unchanged between these two games. And that was a little bit of a surprise given the proximity of the Arsenal game on Sunday and kind of the importance of that one. But at the same time, you can see there, like, a couple of wins, a couple of laps of honour, like the things they've been talking about in the press after the game and the things Guardiola's been saying, it feels a lot like he's needed to get the good vibes back into this team.
Yeah, it does. It's not that surprising with Guardiola, though, is it? Like, you know, small squad, keep using the players that you trust. He's showing those players that he trusts them. He's starting Rodri again. Which is good, and I thought he looked, you know,
much better on Thursday than compared to Sunday.
Yeah, you know, the legs are coming back, where you have that doubt in your mind, don't you? Will he ever get there? But he's slowly but surely is incrementally getting back to the Rodri we know and can trust. But yeah, I must admit, I was a little bit surprised, like you say, with the proximity of the Arsenal game, but also, it's Pep, isn't it? He likes to have his trusted generals. So, fair play.
Yeah. Let's talk about Phil Foden, because EJ got in touch to say, although they're laced with nostalgia, will the departures of De Bruyne and Gundogan in particular be beneficial for Foden? He's learnt from the best since he came into the team and he's now carrying the team. When De Bruyne was on the field, everything would rightly go through him. Now the creative spark is Phil and it's really his team now. Bernardo is likely to go next year too. Are we finally getting to see Foden fully come into his own in the creative midfield? And Amos, he ran the show against United. He was absolutely brilliant against Napoli with a great assist. It feels like you don't want to put too much stock in two performances back to back, but it feels like the old Foden is coming back. Like, if he's not back, he is coming back, isn't it?
Yeah, totally. He was my man of match against United, and you know, certainly in the conversation and possibly even best player on the pitch again against Napoli. I'm not saying, and I will caveat this in a second, I'm not saying Phil Foden is back to his best, because for me, Phil Foden at his best is like months at a time, prolonged period of consistent performances at this level. What I will say is Phil Foden is back where he should be, and that sounds like I'm doing him again a disservice. I'm not, you know, probably my favourite City player. If you're allowed to have favourite City players when you're like, you know, mid-20s and over.
You're allowed, definitely.
Yeah.
Although mine's still Mark Kennedy, so, you know.
So I'd say he's back to where he should be in terms of, you know, those sort of levels. And to be fair to him, as bad as last season was, there were the odd match where he would sort of stand on his head a little bit. I remember, you know, he got a couple of goals against Brentford in the game, one of the games where City absolutely, you know, their arse fell out. And then there was the Ipswich performance as well, which I recall being decent. But even still, you know, it felt like at the Club World Cup, he was back playing with a smile on his face. And for me, that's the best Phil Foden, when you can see he enjoys his football, because I imagine the cushy wage and the lifestyle's nice, but I genuinely think he's in it for the love of the game, which sounds, you know, super cliche and cringe, but he does strike me as a player who loves playing football first and foremost.
Mm. Higgy, it must have been nice to see him like nodding that first goal against United, and just kind of, it was like the weight of the world lifted when that went into the net, wasn't it?
It was such a fantastic header. It's a lot more difficult than he made it look. And to follow on from what Amos was saying there, he loves to play football. He loves to play football for City, doesn't he, as well? That's so key. And in his interviews, he just seems to have more of a... He's even got a grown-up haircut these days. He just seems so much more...
Have you noticed in his interviews, he's like... He's saying things. And what I mean by that is, like, in a way where a lot of footballers get put in front of the camera, they do the media training stuff of, good game, yeah, we work hard again for next week. And then you notice, in, like, after the derby, he was talking about how the team had developed in its playing style. And then after Napoli, he was talking like a little bit about the real small details of the game that they did well. And
so I'm
kind
impressive.
Of like that he's suddenly kind of, it's like he's grown in the past year or so 100%. To start like just taking the team, like to be the central part of the team, as EJ has said.
Yeah, he's like part footballer, part club ambassador, and speaking almost like a pundit in the interviews. He's just like... I mean, obviously, you can't avoid cliches because you're talking about a football game that you've just played in. So there's going to be some stock kind of, you know, paragraph A1. Yes, we played well. It was good to see this, that, the other. But yeah, just the way he articulates himself these days, he's really, really seems to have grown up. But it's obviously something. The physical injuries he's had will affect his head, but. I mean, there's been a lot of speculation about what's been up with him psychologically, but he really seems to have progressed and moved past whatever it was that was holding him back. And it's just a joy to see. Technically, he's just on another level to most players that you'll ever see. And for him to be firing all cylinders, it's just not only invaluable for the team, but yeah, just a pleasure to see.
Yeah. Now, when Foden opened the scoring against United, he ran off to knee-slide and celebrates in front of the fans in the Colin Bell stand. He gave a little kiss to the City badge on his shirt as he did. So let's have a look at some of the other times that players have done the same. After a difficult season last year, you could see how important Sunday's goal was to Phil Foden. Here he is speaking to the BBC.
Yeah, it meant a lot to me, obviously, to get back on the score sheet. But first of all... to start a game as well, obviously. I was training really well at the start of the season and managed to pick up two ankle injuries, which was obviously frustrating. So yeah, I've been waiting for that moment to start the first league game this season, and you probably can see the emotion when I scored, how much it meant to me, because you know, I've been working really hard. I know I've been feeling good in training, so I wanted to just put that into the game.
Foden kisses the badge after many of his goals. He did it after his first against Oxford in 2018, and you don't have to look hard for images of him doing it after other goals too. He's not the only Academy graduate to do it either. Nico O'Reilly was asked on the official City podcast back in March what he had planned for his first goal celebration.
First goals. If we're winning, knee slide, kiss the badge.
You heard it here first. Yeah. That'll be cold, yeah. That'll be cold. I've got a lot of time for that. I'm looking forward to seeing it as well.
Hopefully it comes soon.
It did come soon. Around a month later, he opened the scoring in a 2-0 win at Everton and did exactly that celebration. He spoke to Sky afterwards.
I just seen the space, so I thought, run into it. I knew we had cover at the back. I just did it, and luckily Nunes flashed it across and I was there to finish it.
A few months before that, Erling Haaland kissed the badge after scoring in a 6-0 win at Ipswich. That was after he'd signed a 9.5-year contract extension, and he told Sky why he'd signed that deal.
The people I spoke with in the club was so good. I got so motivated, I got so good feelings inside me when I spoke with Kalloon, when I spoke with Ferran, Pep, and all of the bosses. And then in the end, I listened to my instinct and to my feelings inside myself.
Now, when a player kisses the badge, they need to have some sort of connection to the club for it to make sense. Sometimes that's because they're a fan. Sometimes it's because they've come through the academy. And sometimes that connection has built up over time. In 2014, Pablo Zabaleta scored a game-settling goal away at Roma to put City into the Champions League knockout phase. Here he is speaking to reporters afterwards.
We are a club that we want to continue playing in this competition, and because always top clubs and top players deserve to play in the Champions League, and that's why when he scored, I went straight away to them, because we really appreciate the fans who came tonight to Rome. They support the team as usual, and also I'm absolutely sure that a lot of City fans in Manchester are also celebrating that victory.
Zabaleta went crazy when he scored that goal, grabbing his shirt and kissing the badge. City fan Dan Burke spoke about the celebration on the podcast recently.
I had a photo of this as my background on my phone for about 2 years afterwards. Every time I opened my phone, it kind of made me smile. It always reminded me the look in his eyes when he's looking up at the fans. It's like that lyric from The Boy with the Thorn in His Side by the Smiths, where it's like, how can they see the love in our eyes and still they don't believe us? Like, I always think of that when I see that. It's like, there was just pure love in his fans. And like I said, it was reciprocal love. The fans loved him, he loved us. It was the purest love, the purest passion you can hope to get from football.
When we asked on social media for suggestions of players who had celebrated like this, Zabaleta's goal was one of the most popular. A lot of suggestions came for players where they either never spoke about the goal or we couldn't pin down which goal it was. Vladimir Weiss did it when he made it 3-0 against Arsenal in the League Cup in 2009, but he never spoke about it. Paul Dickhoff did it after an FA Cup equaliser at Darlington in 1998, but he also never said anything. And there were loads of pictures of Sean Gota doing it, but we couldn't pin down any of the goals where he'd done it. A lot of fans also suggested Richard Edgell after his penalty in the 1999 playoff final. He told us about taking that kick.
A few of the lads have stayed behind and practiced penalty against Weaves and Big Tommy Wright. And Joe just came up to me and said, would you be willing to take one? And I said, yeah, I had the confidence in training. I'd not really missed too many. And I'd always gone the same way, and the keeper just couldn't seem to save them. So I did have the confidence to take one, and knew that if it went to penalties, I'd be taking one. And then it was only after the extra time had finished that it dawned on me, and I thought, I'm actually going to have to stand up and take one.
Did you mean to get that close to the ball?
No, I didn't. But like I said, I practiced the same way every time, and I'd gone that side of the goalkeeper, and I'd always gone middle of the goal.
Meanwhile, City fan Simon Curtis explains what he thinks is the first time a badge kissing by a City player ever happened.
City were away at Notts County, Meadow Lane, sunny Sunday afternoon. Peter Reid had decided for some reason to put on Clive Allen, who was our sub that day. Allen claimed, since he'd refused a transfer to Luton, that his manager had not spoken to him at all. So they'd fallen out completely. Allen wanted to play, and he wanted to show the City fans that he was one of them. He came on, turned the game, scored a penalty and a brilliant horizontal volley to make it 3-1 for City. After both, he kissed the badge. never been seen before, never been done before. It's the first ever occurrence of city badge kissing. Clive Allen at Notts County.
That happened back in 1991, and we've not been able to confirm if it was actually the first instance of a city badge kissing. But we're willing to go with it until we're told otherwise.
Hi guys, it's David Seaman, ex-City player. I've played a few times for Arsenal as well, and England, but you're listening to the Blue Moon Podcast.
You see stats pop up all the time about clubs and players, and you want to know that exact thing about City. There's an answer. Statcity.co.uk. Want to find out all of the players who played alongside club legends like David Silva, Sergio Aguero or Vincent Kompany? Or maybe you'd like to know which team found it hardest to score past Joe Hart. You can find out City's record in every competition, at every stadium, and under every manager. Just go to statcity.co.uk and browse away. That's statcity.co.uk.
If you enjoy the show, please give it a rating and a review wherever you get your podcasts.
That was sometimes when players have kissed the City badge. And I find that a really, really hard feature to put together, Higgy, because in my mind's eye, there were so many players who did it. But could I find examples of them doing it? Could I, heck?
I couldn't give you one. You'll be probably not that surprised to know.
Yeah.
I mean, I think, I don't know if it was in a WhatsApp chat, but someone was saying, like, it's hard to kind of remember because when we've just scored, you tend to be bouncing up and down, and
yeah, Casey.
Someone you don't know from three rows back's got you in a headlock, sort of thing. So it's kind of missed those bits a lot.
Yeah, but there we are. I managed to find a few. There we go. Let's talk about Erling Haaland, Amos, because 6 goals in 5 games, fastest player to 50 Champions League goals, did it in 49 games compared to Van Nistelrooy's 62. Messi was 66, by the way. 3 different goals against United and Napoli, all very excellently taken. So the question, I guess, is after a season, maybe a season and a half of not particularly feeling inevitable in front of goal, are you getting that feeling back from him?
He's definitely regained his aura, I think. And, you know, there's a lot of City fans saying when he netted 5 against, can't remember, in international duty, you know, oh, he's wasting his goals. He's going to be able to do this in City colours. I was sat there thinking, you know what, that is a great confidence booster for Erling Haaland, who has all the quality. You know, maybe once or twice will have a niggle throughout a season and miss a few matches. But on the whole, he's physically, you know, strong and seems to be, you know, consistently available. His only issue, I felt like at City when he's been in some sort of slumps, has been confidence. And I think you can't downplay the 5 goals on international duty. Well, if 6, I think it was overall. Then coming back, obviously, scoring against United. That first goal is so well taken, but it feels like he's done it about a million times at this point. The second one, you know, we've seen that as well. And I guess maybe the more of the unique one was certainly the Napoli one. Little deft touch over the top with his head. But even still, I think he certainly, speaking of Foden, speaking of Haaland, they are two players that this season have felt like they've stepped into leadership roles a little bit more. Obviously, Haaland literally has because he's part of the captain's group.
Yeah.
I agree. You know, Phil Foden speaking a little bit more like an ambassador, which is, you know, Higgy's spot on saying that. And I do feel like they are taking it upon themselves to almost step into the shadows that have been left behind by, obviously, Gundogan's left, a couple of key players over the last few years as well. So, yeah, totally agree. You know, he's playing with a smile on his face as well, which is important, and looking like when he does get that chance, he's going to take it, which, as you say, wasn't always the case last year.
Yeah. 3 excellent goals this week, Higgy. Which is your favourite on the basis that that first one against United was a very smartly taken little dink? The second one against United, I mean, he's ran half the length of the pitch and
like, it was some offside trap, that wasn't it?
Yeah, well, it was an onside trap. That's the problem. It's run half the length of the pitch, and like it, many players in that situation, they get caught by defenders. You know, they don't make the mind up, or they get to the edge of the box and they've had so much time to think about it, they fluff it, and he just slots it in the bottom corner. And as Amos said, that header against, I mean, a lot to be said about the ball from Foden for that header, but I mean, it's a nice little dinked header.
Yeah, I mean, for me, the header's my favourite one. The others are more kind of bread and butter. It does get, you know, if we're going to criticise Erling Haaland's finishing, there's not much scope to go at, but his heading is, you know, could do with improvement, but that was, as you say, a lovely, deft little header. Well meant, well aimed, and well taken. That was my favourite one. Love a nice header.
Yeah, the dink though, I think, is my favourite for against United, because there were so many like perfect elements to that in the build up to it, where it was like O'Reilly with a little nutmeg, and then it gets to Doku, and I'm just kind of like, play that ball, you got to play that ball, and he plays it, and then Haaland's in, and you're like, oh, he's going to finish this, and then like nice little thing to finish up.
Yeah, it was high skill level all around, to be fair. Beautiful goal.
Let's also talk Doku, Higgy, because two assists against United, causing them problems throughout. Great goal against Napoli. And he's one that I've wanted to see more from over the course of his City career. Are we seeing that now?
Definitely. I mean, they're probably still having nightmares, the United players, the way he twisted them up. And again, the only criticism that you can have of him is his end product, and he's delivering that. So, you know, all boxes ticked, that's what you want. And we get to sing the song. So, yeah, it's quality.
Have you successfully had that song going around the terraces yet?
I would say no. But I've nicely tried, but...
Yeah. Is that because generally people aren't Eddie Grant fans, do you think?
Probably. I think it's there's some sort of cultural void there that, you know, I'm struggling to fill,
Yeah, that'll be it, definitely. Amos, given the state of City last season, and we always talk about attacking players especially, but players in their second season being the time that they develop under Guardiola, given the state of what Doku's second season was, can this season be his second season? Because last season was basically a write-off for not him, but everybody.
I think it's a fair starting point, because last season City was so dysfunctional, and he strikes me as a player who needs that sort of functionality. Although I will say Erling Haaland played the majority of matches. Doku had a couple of injuries here and there, but played a lot. I don't know if you necessarily need a functioning team to combine with the best striker in the world. You know, I'm not an expert, but that sounds as a winger like it's an easier job than, you know, a lot of other wingers at other clubs have. Being said, again, going back to the Club World Cup, I thought he looked really sharp. The talk, I don't know if it's from his YouTube channel or whatever it is, but there've been reports that he's, you know, him and Haaland have worked out some secret language as to how to combine better. These footballers have far too much time on their hands, if we're being honest. They should get part-time jobs in like Asda or something. But
it's nice to hear that they're talking about how to play well together, though, isn't it?
Yeah. After all this time. Yeah, you know, what they've been doing for the last 24, 25 months, goodness knows. But I mean, look, you can't complain. I thought he was excellent. I thought Sunday was his best performance in a City shirt. And I know against Bournemouth, he got four goals and an assist in his first year. But like I think the goal was deflected, and like, you know, a couple of the assists were Foden versus Leicester assists.
Nice little tap to the side. Somebody funders it in from 18 yards.
You know. But I thought he was absolutely excellent against United, and again against Napoli. You know, that's what we collectively have been asking for. So, you know, the shimmies, the shakes, that's fine. Get past the players, he's got no issue doing that. But it's when he gets into the box that's been the issue.
Deliver something, and he has done.
Yeah. And, you know, again, how can you complain when he's doing that? More of it, please.
Yeah.
Do you think a change in the style of our play, the less sort of tiki-taka we are, will help him? Because I think standing start a lot of the time when he's receiving the ball and he's got mass ranks of players against him, that's not helpful for a winger, is it? I think maybe if we're being a bit more direct, which Donnarumma might be a signifier of, but just the way we're kind of evolving as a team, the style of play, I think, will possibly help bring the best out of him as well. So that might be something we're kind of seeing in action at the moment.
Yeah, could see that as well. You mentioned Donnarumma, Higgy. The defence has conceded nothing over these last two games. John got in touch. He said, do you think Kusunov could be the long-term right-back solution for City? Also, do you think Donnarumma, the leadership and organisation from the back that was missing last season, do you think he brings it as well as the shot-stopping?
100%. The man's got an aura, hasn't he? He's an absolute beast. And again, you can't discount the psychological element of that. And I think as much as he brings that aura and that, you know, world-class shot-stopping reputation, I think that when we've had Edison in there, as well as the sort of head loss that he may or may not have experienced due to online abuse, because he did seem to react to it, so it suggests that it was getting to him. But having him in the dressing room and knowing he's not really fully committed, there have been rumours of bits and bobs of dressing room unrest. I wouldn't be surprised if that was an element with Edison.
He's wanted to leave for a couple of years, hasn't he? And I don't know if other players kind of sense that, if you know what I mean.
Well, I mean, they talk, don't they? They must 100% know that for fact. So, you want people who want to stay, don't you? It's just, that's pretty, I mean, I'm no psychologist, but that's pretty obvious to me. You kind of like the team to want to be there. So
yeah, it's kind of psychology 101, that, isn't it? You want a happy workplace, yeah.
Yes, 100%. And if, you know, that Donnarumma brings that as well. I mean, he's stated openly in the press how City were his first choice. That might be bullshit, but it's nice for him to say it. To have everyone, you know, singing from the same hymn sheet, which is an analogy I hate, but yeah, it's really, really positive. And as for Kusunov, I mean, I can't speak highly enough of him. He's an absolute, he's probably my favourite player.
What would it sound like, do you think, like if a church choir, for instance, all had different hymn sheets?
Did they once upon a time have different hymn sheets and they thought, goodness me, this is just not the way to go?
We need to rethink this.
Yeah, we need to standardise this, lads, yeah.
Yeah, just start singing from the same one.
Yeah. Amos, Kusunov, long-term right-back, as John suggests. I'm always wary of making a judgment based on two games, but he's had two pretty solid games, though.
Yeah, totally. Well, he's had three, I think, if you can include the Real Madrid at the Bernabeu game last season. So he's certainly played there before. And I was surprised that we didn't necessarily see it early doors this season, because it feels like one of those things where we all sit there and go, oh, this is painfully obvious. Like, of course he can, he's fast, he's strong, he's got a tackle in him, you know, he's good on the ball. Why does it not, you know, you've not just lost Kyle Walker. I think we lost Kyle Walker spiritually like in 2023, but you know, physically he did leave the club in January. So it made a lot of sense, but I'm going to say long-term right-back, no, in the same sense that I don't think, you know, Gvardiol was the long-term left-back. But I think in terms of this season and possibly even next, it wouldn't be the first time a Guardiola defender has earned his stripes at full-back and then sort of gone into the middle. But I think it's certainly, you know, a show full of cliches, one game at a time, starting at Arsenal. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, he's tailor-made for that sort of game. It'd be really frustrating if we then go and see Nunes or Rico Lewis in that sort of right back role for Sunday's match, because these last three games, oh well, last two and you know, moving on to Sunday, it just feels like the made for him, the guy who loves to sort of barge in and make a big tackle and get the crowd off of me is perfect.
Yeah. Final question for this part of the show, Higgy. It comes from Martin, who got in touch to say, West Ham have banned half and half scarves ahead of their derby with Spurs. Should City be doing the same thing? Many of the old school City supporters of a certain age, including me, would totally agree and find it quite sickening to see them in the home section.
Well, I don't like them, but I don't see the club banning them. I mean, if kids like them, what are you going to do? Like, take the toys away.
Yes.
Yeah.
Do it.
Maybe just don't take them away, but just cut them in half and give them the right half as they go in, just to teach them a lesson.
Yeah, it's interesting, Amos, because I saw in the derby a couple of half and half scarves in the home end, in the concourse as I was walking in. And there was one fella who was quite upset that there was a half and half scarf around the shoulders of somebody walking past him, and had a little word. And I'm interested because obviously, as Higgy says, like, we are all adults. Like they are just a thing. If you don't like them, don't buy one. That should be the baseline of it. But if it's starting to cause a little bit of friction, in the same way that the worker wearing a United top, who turned out to be a YouTuber wearing a United top, it's like if it's going to cause friction, then it shouldn't be there.
Yeah. I mean, I don't get them. I don't get them for the most part. Like, there's so many sort of layers to this. I don't get why anyone would want a Man City Brentford scarf. That's auraless to begin with. I don't know why.
I can get on board with it, weirdly, for European games.
I was going to say, yeah, they're the only times I kind of turn a blind eye because, for example, I love Italian football. And last night, I'm not going to lie, the City-Napoli one looked pretty cool. It wasn't cool enough for me to go and spend 15 quid, whatever it was. But at the same time, that was a little bit different.
But that's it. It's a souvenir, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
We don't have ticket stubs. We don't have, everything's digital. Yeah. Unless you buy a program, which, is awkward to roll up and put in your pocket. A scarf fits nicely around your neck, keeps you warm. You can put it on a wall or you can collect them. I kind of get that, but I would draw the line at a scarf. What pisses me off is people like that attention-seeking United barman. People wearing opposition shirts or even shirts of different clubs. Like, what are you doing? Like, show some respect. It's people getting photos taken in the home end at City in a Barcelona shirt. We've not got a fierce rivalry with Barcelona in any respect, really. But it's just like, why would you? I just don't get it. Like, it's just rude. But I kind of get the souvenir element of a scarf, but don't be turning up.
But not for United. Not a half and half United scarf. Not a half and half Everton scarf, Brentford, Villa, whoever. Yeah.
Yeah.
The United one's bad. The United one's
bad.
That is bad.
I mean, you just wouldn't want it on your skin, would you? Or eyeline.
Yeah. Sunday started with the sad news that the world champion boxer and big City fan Ricky Hatton had died at the age of 46. We spoke to Ricky on the podcast back in 2012-2013 time, and we'll hear some of that interview shortly. I've been speaking to Dom Farrell from Sporting News, who, along with covering City, also reports on boxing.
Ricky Hatton as a boxer, and I've been heartened to see this mentioned in quite a lot of the tributes, because it sometimes got lost within Ricky Hatton, the everyman, the phenomenon, the man that everybody loved, and obviously that is ultimately why we're doing this. But he was a fantastic boxer. And again, Ricky being such a popular, his affable kind of everyman, self-deprecating way. The first guy to talk down Ricky Hatton's boxing ability was Ricky Hatton. And when he became that big crossover star, and maybe a lot of people's first experience of watching him would have been watching him get knocked out by, like, the great Floyd Mayweather, you think, oh, he's a bit of a chance in his arm brawler. He was a fantastic, fantastic fighter. His left hooks to the body were like legendary, but it was the way he'd set those up. His footwork was brilliant. He was so fast. He was super, super aggressive, so was always liable to get hit in return, but he was an absolute nightmare for opponents. He'd never leave him alone. But there was an intelligence to his pressure at his best. As I say, the footwork is phenomenal. The left hooks to the body are like among the great signature punches people have. Like, people talk about signature moves Muhammad Ali might have, or like the great fighters and their great punches. If you talk about left hooks to the body now, I might be doing down a few Mexican greats here, but you're going to talk about Ricky Hatton. He was fantastic. He was a two-weight world champion. We don't have many of them from the UK. He won four world titles. I'd say he's fairly comfortably in the top 20 British boxers of all time. He's arguably in the top 10. He was fantastic. So Hatton comes along at a time when boxing is a little bit... Boxing in the UK is half a decade or more removed from... Eubank and Nigel Benn were on ITV, watched by, I think, 17, 18 million people. So it was terrestrial TV. It was a big water cooler national event. Boxing then goes behind the paywall with Sky when Sky's starting up. So that it vanishes. It takes it away from the consciousness. Now, around the time Hatton comes along is 99-2000 when he first starts getting in like local and national title fights. A little thing around that period, of course, David, as you'll know, is 1999 is when a load of City fans are getting Sky so they can get Colchester away on pay-per-view. so that's a nice little coincidence. He was a guy people latched onto. He was kind of like that terrestrial era star from a time when boxing had just moved away from that. So that gave him the crossover. But then, as someone now who writes about boxing, I wouldn't have wanted to write about boxing without Ricky Hatton.
Mm. You mentioned, obviously, Colchester away.
I'm sorry, of all the things you pick out of that.
But what I was going to say is Ricky would... like. I think that's what that is, a part of that answer that Ricky would like part of the most. Because like around about that time, obviously, he's getting big into the boxing scene. He's obviously, you know, like he's getting his Sky subscription to watch Colchester just like everybody else.
Yeah.
Let's have a listen to him. Like, because I interviewed him for the podcast years and years ago. It was back in 2012, 13 or so. So I asked him a load of questions about why he was a City fan. So let's have a listen to basically his explanation.
Everything's blue, isn't it? The sky, the sea, and the best football team in Britain. So I think it's an easy choice, to be honest. But no, I mean, my dad used to play for City in the reserves years ago. So as a youngster, I was in the FA School of Excellence as a 12, 13-year-old. So I think with the family history, it was only common sense that I was going to follow in the family's footsteps. The first Manchester City game I ever went to was the 5-1 derby. I went with my uncle Jed and in the north stand there, the 5-1, when City won at Main Road 5-1. I was always destined to be a City fan with the way the family had gone. But, I mean, as a youngster, you know, you're always thinking, am I going to go City? Am I going to go United? And if there was any doubt in my mind, if that was my first game, then my mind was well and truly made up. 5-1 back in the days, you know, of Ian Brightwell and David White, Trevor Morley, and all them players. It only seems like yesterday.
It's amazing that. So I went into this interview knowing nothing about boxing, and we just chatted about City.
There's a lovely thing during the tributes that I heard Steve Bunt say. Everybody had a Ricky Hatton story, and he recounts like when he was out in Vegas for one of the big nights out there, he was like sort of saying to a colleague, going, "Look, no, they have." And they were picking out random people and asking about coming out to see Ricky, and sure enough, they all had a personal story. And everyone did. I mean, so, and I have one from the very small hours of the morning after the Aguero game. There's an after hours bar me and some mates were in. I'd say it was about 4 in the morning, and Ricky comes in. And the place like erupts again because it's tricky. So I tried to buy him a Jaeger bomb, which his minder, who was about the size of a door, told me firmly and politely that he'd rather I didn't. So then I ended up just prattling on to Ricky about how brilliant he was against Costa Zoo that night. And I remember thinking afterwards, he'd rather I'd talked about the football. You know, and the thing is, and he nodded along graciously and happily, as if it was the first time a drunk had barked the story at him. But he found the self-deprecation so easy. He'd much rather talk about City than how great he was. And while that was massively endearing, because with boxing, there's so much ego involved in sort of persuading yourself to do that. And like, having been lucky enough to be around fighters... The fighters predominantly, I mean, there are some wrong ones around boxing, but the fighters are good souls, just like very pure people, I tend to find. But because of, you know, trash talking or whatever else, or loyalties, people will divide opinion. I've thought about this a lot the last few days. It's just been said as a truism that everybody loved Ricky, but it's mad how everyone did, because everyone doesn't love Tyson Fury. Everyone doesn't love Anthony Joshua. Anyone who gets to that, there are loads of detractors. And listen, I'm sure there might have been one or two top Reds who got really into Floyd Mayweather around 2007, but genuinely, everybody loved him, and he always wanted to talk about something other than that, which is to his credit, but there's also, like so much of this at the moment, it's just tinged with a lot of sadness.
Yeah. You talk about meeting him there as well. So I also asked him if he ever got starstruck meeting the City players, because I always find it mad when, you know, like when somebody who is famous for being great at their thing gets starstruck by people who are in other fields, basically. So I asked him if he ever got starstruck by meeting City players.
Every time I see one of them, it's great, you know, and the fact that they know me, it's you know, it's great. I mean, they're not in my mobile phone or anything like that. But I mean, whenever I go out, they always say, "Hey, Rick, you okay? Do you want a drink? Hey, how are you doing? How's your training going?" You know, it's really do have to pinch myself. I mean, when I was a youngster, when I was growing up, all I wanted to be was a world champion, support Manchester City, and listen to Oasis. And when you think all the City players sort of like know me now, you know, and Oasis have carried me belts, and then I can call them friends and became a world champion, you know, I feel very, very blessed in what life has given me, I guess.
You did it all that you said. How many of us can say that? They don't want to sound glib, because 46 is no age. I was saying this actually to someone, that before the game, I didn't know whether it was going to be a minute's silence or a minute's applause, because minute's applause is generally for someone who's lived like a very, very long, full life.
Mm.
Younger deaths, it's like that would be the silence. But then who lived a fuller life than Ricky Hatton? And then, like, because the thing that I always found mad was he apologised for losing to Mayweather and Pacquiao. It's like the two best boxers of this century. It's all right. Who do you think you've let down here? It's like, you know, it does my head in. Do you remember when Aguero did that Panenka and put an apology on social media? It's like,
yeah.
I just, sure, it's fine. He let people down. I mean, and obviously there was this well-documented sort of struggles outside the ring. I mean, around the time dickheads like me were trying to buy me a Jaeger bomb, for crying out loud. But he felt like he'd let people down. He'd never let anyone down.
Let's talk about Blue Moon, because he always walked into the ring with Blue Moon. And I asked him, basically, like in my mind, like walk-on music should be the sort of thing to get the blood pumping and get get the crowd on the feet sort of thing. And Blue Moon doesn't scream that to me.
Without a dream in my heart, without a love of my... It's such a miserable song, isn't it?
I know.
Although, actually, it's the final verse of it is actually quite uplifting, but yeah. I love that City just loop the miserable bit.
Yeah. But so basically, I asked him why he picked Blue Moon, and this is what he said.
One thing, the reason why I had the fan base is because you can't fool the public, you know what I mean? You know, I support City not just because I want all the City fans to support me. I support City because I simply support City, you know what I mean? Even before, you know, when it was Richard Hatton and I was an amateur and I was a 13-year-old where no one had even heard of me. I used to have my season ticket, you know, and I used to go out. And so the minute I got to, like, 19 years of age and Sky Television said, "We need some entrance music, Ricky. Can you think of anything?" I thought, "Yeah, I've got something ready for you." And it was Blue Moon all the way. There is nothing false about my support of City. I didn't do it just to enhance my fan base, if you get me meaning. I did it, you know, because, you know, I'm a big Blue. But I'm a fan of Manchester in general. I mean, come Derby Day, I hope we absolutely give him a whooping, you know, down Man United down the road. But I've had a lot of support from Man United fans over the years, as well as Man City, so I've got to be careful. I mean, it is a little bit fierce come Derby Day, but it's all in good fun. I'm proud of Manchester, whether you're a Blue or a Red.
That thing, what he said about when he was around the time when he was coming up and he was noted as a City fan, honestly, it seemed like he did the half-time draw at Main Road every other week. I wonder if Adam Carter might have this. If has anyone got stats on whether Ricky Hatton had more half-time draws than he had title fights? Because I reckon it's a pretty close-run thing. He's part of that massive Manchester story, isn't he? He is, you know, City, United, Oasis, bucket hats, Ricky Hatton. I mean, sound like a Norwegian football commentator. But he is part of that. I don't sound like a clanging name drop, but I was out in Abu Dhabi covering some boxing in 2022, and I was trying to sort out an interview with Freddie Roach, like the very famous boxing trainer who trained Pacquiao when he fought Hatton. An interview I ultimately failed to arrange through his PR, but while they were trying to work out how it fit into Freddie's schedule, I was just sitting in the hotel lobby, sort of just chatting to him. He said, so you're from England, where are you from? I said, Manchester. And he goes, how's Ricky Hatton? As if, like, we all know him. it often gets said that thing of, like, how, you know, Irish people get irritated by everyone assumes everyone from Ireland knows everyone. How's Ricky
You must Hatton? Know him. Yeah, you must know
yeah,
him.
Yeah. But, like, over the last few days, been thinking, in a funny way, we sort of all did.
And I guess, as well, Dom, just to finish, like, obviously, in the audio there, he said, come Derby Day, you know, I hope we give him a whooping. The result was absolutely perfect for Ricky on Sunday, wasn't it?
Yeah, I think it's perfect that Phil Foden scored too. Both born in Stockport, weren't they? And I know Phil talked about being motivated to do it for Ricky before the game. Because obviously, again, we talk about that Manchester collective story. With the best will in the world, you know, Jeremy Doku probably doesn't know who he is. But Phil Foden has been brought up in the Manchester sporting community, wanting to play for City. And again, he's a bit too young to remember his fights, I imagine, but he'll have known all about that and was steeped in that. I also thought about, I sort of wrote something to these ends actually after the game. It's quite hard to write, but what he's doing. When Phil spoke to us all after the FA Cup final and like looked a bit like a lost little boy, and he talked about how he'd been having mental health problems and how things have been, there were things that were more important than football away from the pitch. We don't know the details of what Phil was actually talking about there, whereas, you know, Ricky Hatton was a great advocate and spoke very frankly about the depths of his struggles at times and was a big advocate for people getting help. And, you know, he will have, you know, unfortunately he's not around anymore to see this, but he will have, I know for a fact he's helped thousands of people. He'll have saved lives with the way he talked about that. But to see, like, Phil as the homegrown hero and Ricky as that as well. And Phil, who's had, like, you know, struggled a little bit under the weight of it. I know he was never the phenomenon Ricky Hatton was. But the reason we love these sports people, the homegrown lads, is they always are the little boy next door. There's a bit of that that never really changes. And we love that. But also, that can be hard for him for so many reasons that I hopefully have detailed there. I love that it was Foden who got the first goal. And yeah, it was fitting because, as Ricky said, City did give him a good whooping.
This is the Blue Moon Podcast. Listen to it. Drink it in.
That was Dom Farrell talking to me about Ricky Hatton and his legacy. Time now to look ahead to the Arsenal and Huddersfield games. And to do that, we'll bring in Arsenal fan Michael Kashani. Kesh, welcome back.
Hello, nice to be back.
We didn't have you last season, and I realised that I very nearly offended you because basically in the build up to the Emirates game last season, I decided that all the audience didn't need to know how you were going to basically rip us apart before you ripped us apart, and then you did it. Last season was a bit of a whitewash. Is there any reason why this season won't be again?
Mostly the fact that City clearly are a lot better, even though City are really weird, and I can't quite place what's going on. It's obviously still a very good team, but it's not a Guardiola team, and it's then you're looking a bit weird off the ball, which is where it could be, you know, if we manage to hold you off, because obviously we're still very good defensively, probably better than last season, but it could be a situation where we pick you off if you play like you did against United. But City have that much quality that, you know, you get the first goal, or even get an equaliser. And it's a very, very different kind of game. So I really don't know what to expect. Logic says that I feel like we should win, but City do have that quality, and yeah, it's very hard to pin them down.
It's interesting, isn't it, Amos? Because I didn't fancy this game before City got the Thursday night European game this week. And then they get the Thursday night European game and you go, well, the Arsenal game is pretty much a write-off. But then you get a good result against United and you play well against Napoli and suddenly you're thinking, maybe not as done as I thought it was.
Yeah, totally. It's funny because I don't think City, and they very much might not, but I don't think City win at the Emirates if they don't win the previous two. And I don't think City beat Napoli if they don't beat United. So it's kind of been like not a box ticking exercise, but, you know, hurdles to jump over, because it felt like City are in such a fragile place that if they had slipped up in one of these two matches, you know, panic stations would have been back. Is it over? Blah, blah, all the issues. City haven't been perfect by any means, but I think in this new sort of era of Guardiola, where the new players coming in, taking time, and maybe not necessarily as good as the old ones, which is fine because the old ones were bloody brilliant, they are going to be a little bit more fallible. And maybe that helps City at the Emirates, where I think everyone would agree the pressure's on Arsenal.
Higgy, last season was bad at the Emirates, and I mean really bad.
Really bad.
How do they stop that happening again? Because Arsenal will be strong. Arsenal won't give up chances easily. City might do, might not do. I don't, like Kesh says, I don't really know. Kind of, this is kind of like the first big test of the season, isn't it?
It is, and you know, we can't really be overconfident on the back of the good performances we've just put in. I think Kesh is spot on when he describes us as weird. It is a weird look and a weird feel to the team. Obviously, we're in a bit of a transition. Arsenal are kind of fine-tuning their, you know, Arteta's kind of vision. They've nosed ahead of us in terms of quality this last season, really. Maybe maybe two if you look at the results against Arsenal. And yeah, I think for this team, the way it's starting to gel, I think Arsenal might be too big a test because they're far more the finished article than we are, and the state of our kind of personnel and how we're fitting together. But I'll be happy with the draw. Because we are so weird, though, we might well nick it. You don't know how it's gonna pan out. I'm not really looking forward to it, I have to say. It's kind of, in a good way, it's
weirdly become one of those games where I'm actually genuinely tempted not to watch it and just to catch up on it later, because then you can only ever be surprised by a good result. And if you don't experience the bad result as it happens, I've done it at Anfield a few times and been like, actually, I feel all right about this now.
No, you can't do that. I mean, yeah, by all means, like, go off in a huff at 3-0, but you've got to sit through at least the start of the demolition. Nah, I don't know. I think it'll be tight. It'll be certainly, well, I hope it's tighter than last season. And yeah, it's just a lot of trepidation for me. Too tough to call.
Yeah.
Very weird City team at the moment. Well, if we come through that test, though, that will, you know, be a real testament to the direction that the team's going in.
Yeah. Kesh, what do you make of Arsenal this season? Because I can't make my mind up about them, basically, on the basis of the games that I've seen. Because it feels like you could be really, really good and destructive if you choose to be. And there are times when you've chosen not to be.
That's a pretty good assessment. I think the quality is there right through the squad. The question is whether you have those players for the biggest moments. And so discussing with Arsenal fans through the summer, we had the choice between sort of, let's say we dropped about 120 mil on Gyökeres and Eze, and Liverpool did the same on Isak, rough figures. Was two players who are less good than better than one, or do you get the one guy who is your game changer, who would change a lot? And I see the logic on both sides. Actually, I mean, this is a City podcast. So I think it's great ground. I'm very not convinced by Gyökeres. That's kind of heresy among Arsenal people at the moment, because they're really, really talking themselves into him. He's going to be weird because he will score plenty, but I'm really not convinced he's that good.
I spent years saying Haaland can't finish. I mean, look at the one he missed against United, and then the number of goals he scores, it doesn't make sense because he obviously can, but like the misses he makes.
Well, is it that Haaland is the, this is a slight sidetrack, but Haaland's at the point of comparison for Gyökeres as a guy who's not really that involved in play, but can score goals. But like, you see the way that Haaland uses his frame, the way, the variety of finishes he has, and there's not really a comparison. And also the fact that Haaland can do it against anyone, whereas we'll see how Gyökeres does against decent defenders who aren't playing in Portugal. And I've got sidetracked from the main point of question, which is, oh yeah, us this season. So we're in an odd spot because the squad is stacked now. There's quality everywhere. If we get anywhere near the injuries like last season, we should still be fine. Like, we went to Anfield without Saka, without Odegaard, and Saliba came off after 5 minutes, without Havertz as well. And no, we didn't put in an incredible performance, but I went in without wanting to look for where the knives were, and that's incredible progress considering. And so, yeah, even this weekend, I'm not sure if Odegaard's going to be fit, but I'm not that worried if he isn't. Mm. And Saka is what Saka, I'm pretty sure, will be. But yeah, having that rotating cast of really, really good players, that's a real game changer. It's just whether when it comes to a game like Liverpool that we have enough. For anyone who saw it, or anyone who didn't see it even, you know, it was a really tight game, one of those that decided by either a moment of luck or a moment of magic, and it fell their way. But the magic didn't go our way, partly because we didn't turn the screw when they started to put the pressure on us. So that comes down to approach in part, but it's also partly the players we had available. Odegaard was half fit. Eze was, it was his first game after he joined about 5 days earlier. So those moments are going to be the question, but we should roll over most teams we come against, and then it's a question of how City do and how Liverpool do, and that's you've got to keep looking over your shoulder because we can't just look to ourselves at that point.
Yeah, what has changed from previous seasons in that regard? Because it feels like, certainly from the outside looking in, it feels like Arteta's really leaning into the sort of like the big guys be solid sort of identity. And like when I look at, like, certainly physicality wise, I one thing I've thought about City over the last kind of 12, 18 months is that they don't really have the guys that can knock players around anymore in the way that they used to. But it feels like Arteta's really leaned into that. Is that fair?
Definitely. It's whatever the position is, you want a strong player, ideally one over 6 foot for Arteta, but you know, you can't get them all the time. But it's definitely a big, strong team. It's sort of, in terms of Arsenal teams in my life, it's more physically similar to the Invincibles than anyone else, because they could all play, but they were big, big fellas. Hmm. And that's clearly the direction he wants to go, and he wants that robustness. And I think it's often confused with him being an especially defensive manager, and I think there's too much cautiousness with him at times. But we play some pretty expansive football. Like even the game against Liverpool, I think we could have pressed them a bit more, but they could have pressed us a lot more and got hit on the break as well. It was a very cagey kind of game. And I think the whole him being defensive thing is overplayed by big moments like the 2-2 at yours last year, where he definitely lent too far in the first bit of the first half into the 4-5 or 5-4 or whatever it was we actually played in the end. But that's a bit of a barrier in there, but there's definitely a real focus on being bigger and stronger as well as more technical.
Hmm. Yeah. Higgy, after the Spurs and Brighton debacles and the weaknesses that City showed in there, they've now had United and Napoli. I said at the start of the show that it felt like confidence was coming back. How far has the confidence come back for this one? Because all of those weaknesses that City showed against Spurs and Brighton are effectively still there. It's whether they have done a good enough job over the last couple of games to kind of rectify what those problems were going into a game against a top side.
Yeah, it's hard to say, isn't it, without actually the proof's in the pudding, isn't it? It's hard to say without seeing how they perform against Arsenal, but definitely there did seem to be a bit of swagger back against Napoli. I do worry, though, about, you're talking about physicality. The game's definitely shifting towards a more of an emphasis on physicality. You saw us against Tottenham, we were just getting bullied. I still worry about Reinders getting knocked off the ball a lot. Was it last week you had, was it John McKenzie, or was that the week before?
A couple of weeks ago, yeah.
Yeah, he was talking about, that was really good to listen to him talking about the shift towards, you know, these big units, footballers, more physical specimens over technicality. But obviously you need the combination. But you can be as technical as you want. If you're against a similarly technical player who's bigger and stronger than you, you're going to come off worse, aren't you? And I do worry about some of our players in that respect. So that might be where the game's won and lost, and maybe lessons will be learned as we continue to kind of evolve. It's going to be pretty surprising and pretty miraculous, I think, if we win at the Emirates. I'd absolutely snatch your hand off at the shoulder for a point.
Not really your hand at your shoulder, though, is it?
Well, that's how big a bite I'm taking, David.
Yeah. Amos, obviously, Higgy's nailed his colours to the mast there about being desperate to take a draw out of this game. What would you like to see from Guardiola to make sure that this team is as solid and stable as it can be? And I'm thinking, he's gone unchanged in the last two games. The close proximity of Napoli to this one, surely he can't go unchanged again. But it feels like that team that he's named in the last two games, probably the most stable one that the City have got right now.
Yeah, it feels like it's early enough in the season to get away with playing the same 11 for three matches. But if you pick up one injury, you go, was it worth it? I was stunned that he went unchanged against Napoli. But I think, you know, we spoke about the vibes, or the vibes, as Pep would say.
Says, yeah.
Yeah. And it does feel like it has kind of, you know, they have been running on that a little bit, which is fine. Like, momentum and good feeling counts for a lot in football. And City certainly had bad vibes against Spurs and Brighton. But yeah, they've got good vibes now. So yeah, I think I was in the same way. I was stunned that City didn't go, that, you know, there wasn't any changes against Napoli. I'm going to be stunned if there are now against Arsenal, just because of how it kind of sets up. What do I want to see from City? A performance that is markedly different than the one that we saw at the Emirates last season. You know, if City come away from this game,
surely shouldn't be that hard to achieve, though,
well,
should it?
Yeah, I mean, you'd hope so. And, you know, that Spurs game, I don't think City... I think the Spurs game, the biggest contributor to that was, you know, Higgy's right in the terms of the physicality. And Spurs had like six games in pre-season. City had had, including the Wolves game, two at that point. So I'm hoping a few more minutes in the legs, City will be able to compete a little bit more. If it's a 2-1 defeat, but City have played well,
I'd be happy. At the same time, if they absolutely fluke a 1-0 and get away from the Emirates. A little bit like, I think it was Martinelli off Ake's face a couple of years ago. You know, if City can do something like that, I'd, you know, be dancing from the ceiling. Not quite taking someone's shoulder off with me, but at the same time. But I'll maybe stop at a handshake.
Yeah. Which body part would you give up for a win at the Emirates this weekend, Amos?
I'll just be totally honest.
Get the measure of where you're at, where you're up.
I'll
to.
Be totally honest. I will not be dissembling any part of my body for this. For City getting a result at the Emirates, I'm happy to keep all sort of digits and limbs and all sorts intact. I'm afraid, sorry, City fans, I'm not going that far just yet.
No commitment to the cause. That's what I'm hearing here. Kesh, who's playing well at the moment for you? Because I've only really seen Arsenal. I saw a bit of the Liverpool game. I saw a bit of the United game where I couldn't. Everyone was banging on about how great United had been in that game, and I was like, I'm sure if Arsenal wanted to turn it up a bit, they could. Like, so who's been playing well right now?
All the defenders, which, you know, does not go again, does not help my point that Arteta's not as defensive as people think. I think Zubimendi's the big one in terms of the dynamics of the team, because a big part of the reason we were quite shit last year, regardless of the injuries, was the fact that we had a big lug in midfielder who I'd rather not name. And the, regardless of anything else about him as a person and the fact that he shouldn't have been playing for very many reasons, he was also shit. And it was a real, real problem that Arteta had this massive blind spot for him, because he made us much worse as a team. Like we got worse even when the season before, 23-24, when obviously he won it on the last day. But we'd had this crazy run. It was always Jorginho in midfield. He brings the other fella back in, and we you know, when you're carried by the momentum of the results before rather than your performances, because we got a lot worse very quickly. So Zubimendi is a big one. He settled in pretty well pretty quickly. I think there's another level in him, but that's big for the dynamics of the team in terms of being able to actually control games. Madueke started really nicely, and he's sort of been thrown in a little bit. So I think a lot of the idea was that he would start on the left. Well, Saka obviously keeps a spot on the right. Saka's been injured. Like I said, I think Saka will be back. And if I were a betting man, I'd say that Madueke starts on the left wing to run at Kusunov a bit. Kusunov is the one playing right back, right?
We've just talked about this in the review bit. We don't know whether he'll stick with it, but it kind of feels like he should.
Yeah, I mean, I can't think who else would play there at the moment. But then I don't know your squad as well as you guys do.
Could be Rico, could be Nunes.
I mean, I'd be quite happy to see Madueke against any of them, or Eze for that matter. So Eze's sort of getting to grips with things, and as much as I don't think he's great, Gyökeres has scored in the home games, and that could be a big difference maker as well if we can make that sort of space for him. The big one really is Mosquera. He's a boy we signed off Valencia, about 15 mil. He's coming, obviously covering for Saliba isn't easy, and it's been seamless. He's really, really good. And I think Saliba will probably play just out of the safety. Obviously, you don't want to take any risk against a guy like Haaland, but the new boys have settled in really quickly, and that's been big in terms of just trying to get going very quickly this season.
Yeah. I'm just wondering, Higgy, for City, obviously Rodri has been a big part of City in the past few years, and the reason why City have been able to dominate games in the way that they have done. He wasn't there for last season. He's obviously coming back off this big injury that at the start of this season, you don't want to put too much pressure on him. I'm wondering if I've said it a few times on the podcast, and Guardiola's never done it, but I'm wondering if there's an option going into a game like this weekend where he basically has Nico Gonzalez alongside him.
Possibly. I mean, you can't see him not starting him, but stranger things have happened.
He has to play. I mean, that's the thing, is that one of the big reasons why teams have been able to run through City recently is that he hasn't been there.
Well, yeah, and you saw against Brighton as well, when he went off, it seemed to give them confidence that they could kind of do what they wanted. So it proved. You've got to start him, yeah. I would be happy to start Gonzalez alongside him. It's seeing him go off and then Gonzalez coming on would be the worry. But I don't think he's got 90 minutes in him at the Emirates, which is not filling me with confidence. He might feel he has the staff might feel he has, but it just feels like a big risk, doesn't it?
Who would come out though if you were to put Gonzalez alongside him? If you take Bernardo out, you're losing a player. Certainly from the recent setup, you're losing a player on the wing. You don't have the width that you previously had. You may be asking Kucinov to get up and down the line a bit more. If you take out one of the central players, it's a bit of creativity with Reinders or Foden. I mean, you can't take Foden out after recent performances. So you'd probably end up having to take Reinders out. Maybe.
I would take Reinders out. Yeah, again, like saying earlier about the physicality element, I think that's what we should do. Bernardo, I think, is playing well. He's not the Bernardo of old, but I think he is wise enough and a good enough footballer to kind of adapt as he ages and his body is capable of different things. Really important head to have in there. Definitely Reinders would go out for me.
Yeah, and just on the duels, Amos, can City win enough of them? Can they win enough at the back for the defence to be stable? And can Haaland win enough at the top end to hold it up?
That's why I would have Nico Gonzalez alongside Rodri, because of the dual winning, which I think is going to be a massive part of this game. Especially, you know, second balls, which is something that Guardiola spoke about, I think, in his first ever press conference at City, or one of the first ever press conferences. And like, it kind of has been. City have obviously been really good at it at times, and they've also been really bad at it at times, and it's always been that sort of one lingering issue throughout his tenure. I think if City do get a thump in, it will be because they're giving the ball away too easy, and Arsenal's transitions will just hurt them. I have been impressed. Obviously, Wolves was easy to be impressed with Reinders against Wolves. I was actually impressed with him against Napoli, and a little bit so against United, in the sense that it just felt like it was 1 or 2 millimetres sometimes, the passes from not necessarily being pulled off, as opposed to sort of just being absent, Calvin Phillips sort of level of just that not being there in the game. I think Reinders will come good, but I do agree with Higgy in the sense that this is a big test for him physically. And when we last had a team who, you know, fitter physically, Spurs, he did go missing a little bit. So I would not be against a double pivot of Rodri and Nico Gonzalez, and obviously you'd have Foden in front of him. And I mean, you get the stability from Bernardo being there as well. So I think that's totally serviceable. And I'd be happy to see
it. But do you think
he'll
go unchanged?
I think he'll go unchanged. I do.
Yeah.
For the vibes.
Yeah. Cash, I mean, in terms of this season as a whole, where do you think Arsenal are at for a title challenge this year? Purely because I see a lot of talk all the time of Arteta has to win something. And like, as much as I want to rally against it, it does kind of feel like this needs to be the season now, doesn't it?
It's a tough one, because every season needs to be the season in that way. And, you know, like it's all about the way you don't win. Like, if you don't win. And obviously, as an Arsenal fan, I've got used to not winning. But there's... take 22-23, that was sort of an unexpected title charge. You'll end up winning the treble. Like, that's, it's a behemoth to come up against. I remember talking to you when just before we played in Feb, and saying that City at that point were Skinner chasing Bart in and the non-giving up school guy, going right underneath the water and then coming back out. And then City the season after, obviously it was a bit more of an even keel rather than being chased. But we won, I think, 16 out of 18 in the back half of the season. Like, You don't win the league from there. Like, you've done pretty much all you can. That's just one of them. And then last year, we were really shit in the league and we didn't deserve anything. We're unlucky in the Champions League, just didn't quite have what it took to get past PSG. It happens. But in that sense, if we have another 23-24, we finish 1-2 points off and it goes right to the final day, then that's a toss of a coin. But if it's
kind of, so be it, isn't it? Yeah
exactly. Whereas if it's like last year and without even a Champions League one to go with it, then you've got to really look and think, what are we doing here? So I mean, it is getting to the point where, like, you, an FA Cup, and you know, I love the FA Cup, but like, it would, in terms of like the realistic signs of progress, we know that a cup only means so much, like, but in terms of actually the spirit around the place, I mean, I'm a League Cup abolitionist, which I don't think will go well on a City podcast.
No, it doesn't go down well here. Don't you dare come for the sacred Carabao like this.
but even that, it just... exactly. No, but in that sense, like, it's the way that it changes the perception of the whole thing, and like, it's not entirely logical, because logical is about, you know, league progress and what you can really see in the big moments. And we were good in big games for years. We finished 84 points, 89 points, and but a cup, which it just, you need, I think we just need something in order to get that away from us, because, you know, when we went 9 years without a trophy between 2005 and 14, like that. The problem was that team was actually capable of loads. We won 3 FA Cups in the next 4 years, but the team got a lot worse. Like, we didn't put a decent title challenge together in those years. We were worse, but we won stuff. And that was but in between 5 and 14, we were actually really good. We just missed that final piece. And I would hate for this team to become another one of them. But it's a reminder that, you know, the trophies aren't really that much a measure of success outside of the league in terms of the strictness of how you're growing. But yeah, we need to win something. We just need to get that away from us, because the more it doesn't happen, the more it doesn't happen.
Yeah, and I said this about City back in the early days of the takeover. If you keep saying, oh, I think this year may be a year too soon for a title challenge, and you get to next year, suddenly you're 5 or 6 years down the line, and it's been next year for too long, yeah. And you can't let it keep getting to that stage. And I just wonder if Arsenal are in a similar sort of position.
I'd say definitely. In that sense, we kind of need our 2011 FA Cup, but we didn't get it back when that was, you know, when the best time to win that would have been 22-23, when sort of that would have been a real mark of progress. Now, FA Cup doesn't really feel like, I mean, I want to win an FA Cup, don't get me wrong, but like, it doesn't feel like it would be as big as it would have been then. But it's very hard to go from not winning anything to then going to win the league.
Yeah,
it's a very, very different discipline.
Yeah, for sure. Cash, before we let you go, we got the charity bet coming up a bit later on. We need a score prediction from you for this. So how do you think the game's going to go? What are you going for?
I've gone optimistic. I think I usually do when I'm on, but I've gone for 2-0 to the Arsenal.
Cool. Well, I hope it isn't, but if it is, at least we win some money. So thank you very much for being with us. Cash, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thanks very much. Thanks for having me.
Arsenal fan, Michael Cashani.
You're listening to the Blue Moon Podcast. You've made it this far, so don't give up now.
Now, before we get some predictions, City also go away to Huddersfield in the League Cup this week. So let's hear the thoughts of Matt Shaw from the podcast, And He Takes That Chance.
It's not the tie I wanted, which is no disrespect to Man City, but Huddersfield haven't been past this round of the League Cup since 1999. So it would have been nice to have that as a marker to take to the rest of the season to get further. And it feels like when you pull out a Man City, an Arsenal or somebody like that, it's kind of like automatically the end of the road. But I mean, you never know, do you? There's always that small percent chance that you can maybe shock someone, like Swansea shock Forest last night, for example. So you never know. But I mean, playing Man City, it is nice to play someone like Man City. And you see if they do come, the likes of Foden, Haaland, etc. on the pitch at Huddersfield, which is always something really nice to see. But it does kind of feel like it may be a bridge too far, but you never know. Maybe we can drag this to penalties and make it a hat trick. Who knows?
Yeah, I was going to say, been penalty specialists so far, knocking out Leicester on penalties and then Sunderland on penalties. I mean, like, is that the game plan? Is that like, take it to penalties? Because I mean, City historically over the last few years, not been great at penalties as it is. And you know, if it's your way through, maybe that's the answer.
Not really. Other Huddersfield get hammered for penalty shootouts a lot, because basically we got from so this is like pub trivia, if you like. So Huddersfield Town got from League Two to the Premier League via penalty shootouts, effectively. So we were promoted via the playoffs from League Two in 2004 on a penalty shootout at Cardiff, 2012 at Wembley to get promoted from League One. On penalties. So, and then obviously 2017, we won the semi-finals and the finals via penalty shootouts, which we seem to take a lot of heat for from people. But when Italy win the Euros, no one blinks an eye. But, you know, we'll put that to one side, you know.
I've always said Italy and Huddersfield, so like similar to that.
Yeah,
sort
rolls
of
off
vibes,
the tongue, doesn't it? Rolls off the tongue. So many, twinned with Huddersfield, Italy. But yeah, there's, I think the game plan will be to sort of, we're not really a team that keeps it tight, but we can be quite passive at times. And in League One, that gets us caught out. But I think when we've played against Leicester and Sunderland, our passive periods have come with a little bit of defensive determination. And I'll be honest, we're in the League Cup. Your opposition aren't always at 100%. So I think our game plan will be to pass it, but to counter and attack when we can. I don't think we will sit back for the entire game. If we're not attacking, it's because Man City are too good for us, basically.
Yeah, I mean, let's touch on Lee Grant, because I believe this is first season in charge, is it?
Yes, it's his first season in charge. Huddersfield first season as a manager. He impressed a lot during the interview phase. I mean, when we got him and his first initial interviews, he did kind of feel a little bit Gareth Southgate-y in a lot of ways. He kind of felt, not a criticism, but it was like more of an observation, was that he sounded like he'd swallowed an FA coaching manual and a cliche book, you know, that kind of thing. But he talks quite well, but I think when you're from Huddersfield, and you know what Northerners are like, and Manchester's not that different, is it? You know, when people are talking about past detailing and the group rather than the team, it kind of gets some people's backs up a little bit. I quite like him and the way he speaks, but a lot of people are like, what is this guy? He's like snake oil salesman, because he's talking in a language that people didn't speak in the 80s. So, you know, Huddersfield fans are quite on board. He started quite well. We've tailed off recently, and our away form is shambolic, to put it mildly, at the minute. This isn't all Lee Grant, but we've lost we've lost 9 of the last 10 league games away from home, and we're losing at Bradford on Saturday was, I think, end of a honeymoon period and any goodwill with Lee Grant, because we were pathetic, to put it mildly, against what was a very ordinary team.
Yeah. This one is obviously at Huddersfield. Your home record, meanwhile, I mean, I know you've got another home game before we get to there, but your home record's pretty good. How are you playing at the moment? What should City expect from you?
Do you know what? I think there are similar parallels to last season. I know a lot of Man City fans might not know what's going on with Huddersfield, so I'll try and be as detailed and quick as possible. But last year, when we had Michael Duff as manager in League One, we won quite a lot of games going up to Christmas without looking particularly convincing. So we went on a 13-14 game unbeaten run. To be honest, we could have lost half of them, and we didn't look particularly dominating. Start of this season, we're 100% at home. We beat Leyton Orient 3-0 on the opening day. But since then, we've pretty much been second best in a lot of those games in the league. We've been pretty good. We were good against Leicester. It was a good game plan against Leicester. But in the league, Peterborough came last week, who were bottom of the league, and with a better side for an hour, it was really poor. So far, I think the biggest sort of observation again about Huddersfield is that they play well for about 15 minutes a game, and they play really badly for about 15 minutes each game. And it just depends if they can capitalize in that good 15-minute spell or they capitulate in that bad 15 minutes. And three times away from home, we've capitulated in that 15-minute spell, Blackpool, Barnsley and Bradford. But at home, against your Leyton Orients, etc., Peterborough, we've put a good spell together and put the game away from them. And 75% of our goals scored this season have actually come after we've made three substitutes. So if we can get laterally to the end of the game within touching distance, we usually have enough in the lower leagues to then sort of alter things and overpower opposition. But obviously Man City might be slightly different to Peterborough.
Yeah, I mean, in terms of kind of an atmosphere for a midweek League Cup tie, what will it be like for this one? Because, I think of some games. You think of like FA Cup weekends, and like if this was a Saturday afternoon in the FA Cup, I don't know if it would be a different kind of vibe. Do you know what I mean?
I don't think anyone cares about the League Cup enough. I don't mean to sort of downplay it too much, but I think the Cups are just... I think it's mostly media driven, isn't it? And why not blame Man United and Steve Bruce for going off to Brazil in 2000? He was Huddersfield manager at that time as well, where Man United didn't go to the FA, they weren't in the FA Cup third round, and Steve Bruce left Huddersfield as manager for a couple of weeks to go cover Man United in Brazil, which was, so we can both share that little quirk.
I didn't know that, you know, that's mad. That is absolutely mad.
There you go. I don't think it was a couple of weeks, but it felt like it when he was over there on TV. But yeah, he left Huddersfield and went over. And we went down the pan after that, and so did the FA Cup. So there we go, maybe the two are intertwined. But I think in terms of the Cup, Huddersfield haven't sold out this game. I think you have to kind of understand where Huddersfield fans are as well at the minute. Without being too unkind to Huddersfield fans, and I'm one of them, we can be quite a self-deprecating bunch. And when things aren't particularly well, a lot of Huddersfield fans you probably don't want in the trenches sometimes. They kind of just go, no, I'm not going. And they're kind of like, they're very quick to throw the towel in and not go. Where idiots like me sit there through the pain. But it does make the good times better. But So we haven't particularly sold out. But the reason for that really is because since we got relegated from the Premier League, when you might have last noticed us, it's just been one long, I don't know if you've seen the South Park episode with the Rochambeau in it. It's basically just been one long kick to the nether regions for the last 7 years. Even the good season ended in a bad note where we were done over by VAR and John Moss to get to the back to the Premier League. Every other season since then has just been really poor and underwhelming. And Huddersfield fans are kind of fed up. And Man City, big draw as they are, great club, etc. I like Man City, got a lot of time for Man City. I'm going to the game, but a lot of fans won't because they've seen Huddersfield against Man City before. They've seen Huddersfield get battered by Man City before. And they'll just go, do you know what? I can't be bothered. Huddersfield usually let us down. Man City always batter us. I can't be bothered. And I think that's the headspace of quite a few Huddersfield fans at the minute. And it's a shame because when you get a full stadium at Huddersfield, as we saw in the Premier League, and it rocks, it's good. And it's
bouncing, isn't it?
Yeah, it's really good. But it's not bounced since. Lee Grant kind of looked like he was getting it back for a few minutes. And then that defeat at Bradford has really just kicked everyone in the nuts again. And everybody's just kind of now going, oh, is it just yet another false dawn? And we've had 7 years of promises. And our owner from America, who is very quirky, looks like Papa Dalmio, is quite active on Twitter. Nice guy. Talks a lot. And the delivery doesn't back up the talk all the time. You know, he said we'll be in the Premier League in 3 years. And this is our third season and we're a division lower than where he started. And things like that just kind of grind people down. So I feel as a fan base, we've been ground down. Man City, as great as a club they are and as much fun their team is to see, Huddersfield aren't at the minute. And I think that's basically why it's not a sellout. Whereas I think at FA Cup, Huddersfield on the up, it would sell out. Like we played each other in the Cup, didn't we, in 2017 before we got promoted to the Premier League? I think that's still our biggest attendance at the stadium for an FA Cup game. And it would have been pushing that had we not been so bad for 7 years and people just are fed up, basically. Yeah. Something, David, I'm sure you know a lot about, Man City fans know a lot about if you followed them in like the late 90s, early 2000s, etc.
Yeah, I was going to say, I don't wish to be mean about it, but there's a generation of City fans who know exactly how all of that feels. And yeah, there's kind of two ways it can go from my experience with City. Either, you know, the fans just kind of get disillusioned and disappear, or they turn up week in, week out purely to just abuse the players and nothing else. So
That's the Northern thing. So Lee Grant and Kevin Nagle have coined this Northern football thing. And that's Northern. And everyone's going, what's Northern football? And you've just encapsulated it there in like 10 seconds of what Northern football is. So this is Northern football. Either disappear or abuse your own.
Yeah. Well, Matt, we've got a charity bet coming up a bit later on. What would your score prediction be for that? We take the score at 90 minutes. What are you going for at full time?
I'm going to go 3-1 Man City. I think it's probably a bridge too far for us. I think we'll look good for little spells of it. But I think if Man City play pretty much any of their first team squad, it'll be too strong. And it's a competition which Man City tend to win on and do quite well in. So I don't think Man City are one of those teams who will send out a youth team and play at 50%. So I think Man City will take it. But I think Huddersfield will show up well and I'll go 3-1.
This is the Blue Moon Podcast. But don't worry, it'll be over soon.
That was Matt Shaw from the podcast, and he takes that chance. No wins on the charity bet so far this season, so let's try and change that. William Hill has given us 3 £10 correct score singles on City's games, and the winnings are going to the Man City Fans Food Bank Support Group. 2 more chances this week. We've already heard from Kesh that he's gone for a 2-0 win for Arsenal in this one on Sunday. That's 9-1 and £90 if he's right. Amos, what are you having for this?
I've gone for 2-1 Arsenal. I said it a little bit earlier on in the show that I know. But usually when I bet against City, they win. I'm like, you know, people who say, oh, you can never bet against your own team. You absolutely can, because I'm convinced I've caused some of City's best ever results by like lumping on the opposition and then it not happening. So anyway, you asked me what limb I'd get rid of. Maybe I'd get rid of a tenner. But I think, you know, I can see it being a tight game. I can see City scoring, don't get me wrong. I think Arsenal are just about favourites. But yeah, if it's the opposite scoreline, I won't be surprised.
Yeah, well, 2-1 Arsenal is 7-1 and £70 if you're right. Higgy, you said earlier you'd be happy with a draw, so what have you gone for?
I've gone with my usual wild optimism and gone for Arsenal 1, Manchester City 2.
Well, if that comes in, that's 11-1 and 110 quid if you're right. So fingers crossed for you there. We heard from Matt that he's gone for a 3-1 Huddersfield defeat, which is 10-1 and £100. Amos, what are you having for Huddersfield?
I've gone for Huddersfield 0, Manchester City 3. And if my theory beforehand is anything to go by, that obviously means City will be knocked out of the League Cup in the in the third round. No, I think you'd expect a lot of rotation there, but I'd still think against a League One team, City should have enough.
Should be all right, shouldn't they? 11-2 and 55 quid if you're right. Higgy, give us the good news, mate.
I've gone for Huddersfield 1, City 4. I have no knowledge of Huddersfield other than we should be comfortably beating them.
Yeah, we should. 12-1 and £120 if you are right. Remember, you've got to be 18 or over to gamble. Prices can change. And for information on responsible gambling, have a look at begambleaware.org. And that's it for this week's Blue Moon Podcast. Thank you very much for listening. And thanks also to my guests for this one. Amos Murphy.
Pleasure.
And Chris Higginbottom.
Thanks for having us.
We've got a clip of this week's Nostalgia Show coming up. That was an opportunistic return to the Blue Moon Podcast Top 10, as City fans Helen Powell and Joe Butterfield picked out their top 10 goals against Manchester United. There's quite a lot to pick from, so if you'd like to hear what they picked, then just head on over to members.bluemoonpodcast.com. It's just £2 a month. I'll be back next week after the games with Arsenal and Huddersfield. See you then.
That was the Blue Moon Podcast. Please give the show a rating and a review where you can. And don't forget, you can listen without the ads by signing up to our Patreon. You'll also get an extra episode each Monday. Here's a clip of this week's.
This is pure emotion because I was on the concourse in the home end. I said I'd never do it. And then I got offered a freebie from work and they were like, but there's a disclaimer. And I think that was just more for pomposity for myself, just really peacocking around. I was stood there and I didn't let on, but I was biting my scarf and like screaming internally. And it was marvellous. And I was behind Bezza and Weta on the way in, who normally I would have been like, oh my God, but I hated him that day. Didn't even say hello. Yeah.
Excellent. And I believe this was the game where Bernardo was holding it by the corner flag and Kyle Walker was kicking it back to the ball boy. So, I mean, could you enjoy that Bertieing?
I did.
In the home end?
Yeah, well, I just sat there with my scarf wrapped tightly around my face. And I was the opposite corner to the away end. And I remember like just at the end of the game, watching all the players go over, watching everyone celebrate. And it was just like, yeah, that's nice. And like, having to occasionally just shake my head and pretend. But it was brilliant. Yeah.
Was that the game where both of our goals bounced off Lukaku somehow before we scored them? Yeah. What a great game.
You can listen to more of that at patreon.com/Blue Moon Podcast and join us again next time for another episode.